every time I call you. Yeah. Yeah.
It's not like I would have changed it. Like, it's not like it would have been recurring.
It uses your texting
device.
Okay, should we start? Just to announce upcoming events. Next week, that's the 27th, Giving Grief a Shape, The Book of Lamentations and the Christian Life by Joshua. And the next one, we do have an event on the North Shore Sunday night, 29th, with some friends of ours that you can see on this if you have that. And then February 3rd, Finding Sabbath Rest in a World That Never Stops with Mary Frances. And the others are a bit off from that. Tonight we'll be doing Salt, Light, and the Transformation of Society. This will be kicking along the can from some lectures I gave a year and a half ago. And I'm meant to be doing in Minnesota next month, so we often give a trial run here, and hoping to get feedback from you all so we can sharpen them up. The questions really are, that I'm trying to deal with, is what should Christians be doing in whatever society they're living in? Are we meant to get along, blend in, and not make waves? Are we meant to withdraw from contact with society entirely because it's very corrupt? And how else will we preserve our children for the faith into the next generation? Are we meant to jump in and try and change it in all the places we think it needs to be changed and transform the society for Christ? Or is there one model at all that applies to all Christians in all societies? Those are huge issues, and many more is much more involved in those than I will be able to tangle with tonight. But it's important to see that these questions divide Christians, not just denominationally, one denomination from another, but within denominations. And a lot of the divisions between Christians within and between within and between denominations actually boil down to how should we relate to our culture? Accepting it, welcoming it, working together with it, standing against it, resisting it tooth and claw, every zillions of options in between. And so I'm going to be looking a little bit at this and hope to shed some light on it. We're in a time which has been widely recognized as having witnessed the failure of the Christian right in the sense that it did not achieve, I'm thinking of the movement starting in the 1970s and aiming it and basically coming on unglued and untogether since then, but it did not achieve its own political goals, was unable to obtain effective unity within itself, and drew lasting hostility and resistance from the very people that it needed to persuade in order to succeed. So what should we be doing now? History is swirling on, not waiting for us to figure out what we're going to do. And it's swirling on around us. What should our priorities be? There is no one template, and I'd love to do a whole lecture on this. There's no template or blueprint in the New Testament about how Christians should relate to their surrounding culture. Nor is there a blueprint in the New Testament about what God's view of the state ought to be, the government ought to be. Just isn't. There's not even as much as people think about the church, the government, how the church should be governed. There's not even as full a developed picture there as most Christians would like. It strikes me that any response has to be very different depending on where we are as individuals, or as a church, and literally where we are geographically, what would your responsibility be if you were living in North Korea now, or in Iran, or in Los Angeles? I mean, really different deal you'd be facing in each of those places. I want to pick up what is, I think, one of the most important New Testament teachings, which kind of, the more I read the arguments of people working things out, the more I think these categories transcend the talking points of the arguments. And the issues I want to talk about are raised by the idea of Jesus telling us that we should be salt and light in the world. It comes from the Sermon on the Mount at the very beginning, right after the Beatitudes, blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. And then which ends with a doubled beatitude, ironically, about the blessedness of being persecuted. You look at it and scratch your head over it. But it's not, it's a very, as most of the Beatitudes are loaded, spring-loaded with irony and force, the blessedness of being persecuted. Jesus then turned and gave his followers basically what I would call a social identity. Who will they be like when they're dropped into larger society? This individual that's described in the Beatitudes, what happens to him or her, drop them into the world, and what happens? He told them, you are going to be the salt of the earth and the light of the world. That would be their social identity. I'll read it to you. This is Matthew 5, verse 13 to 16. I'm going to be in this first section of the talk picking up on a theme that I work on much more fully in the little book that I wrote, Chameleon Christianity. I'll be running with some of those ideas or having a light trip through them anyway here. Matthew 5:13. You are the salt of the earth, but if the salt has lost its taste, how can its saltiness be restored? It's no longer good for anything, but is thrown out and trampled underfoot. You are the light of the world. A city built on a hill cannot be hid. No one, after lighting a lamp, puts it under a bushel basket, but on a lampstand, and it gives light to all in the house. In the same way, let your light shine before others, so that they may see your good works and give glory to your Father in heaven. The positive meaning, which Jesus spends very little time on here, of salt and light. Salt is valuable for its taste. It gives taste to other things that you use to flavor with it. And also as a preservative. Light represents an ideal of goodness and truth, but also is valued for illuminating what would otherwise be in the darkness. I think Jesus assumed we knew perfectly well both of these. They knew salt around them. There was salt around there, which had been so combined with other chemicals that it had lost its saltiness. Looked just like salt, but wasn't salty anymore. And so they would have known exactly what he was referring to. Salt so diluted that it's not salty anymore and is useless. But Jesus is more concerned here, clearly, with the failure to be salt and light. He's dealing in this short passage even, warning mainly about the problem of aborting this mission of being salt and light, missing the boat, dropping the ball here. I suggest that Jesus gives us two different images of ways to be conformed to the pattern of this world rather than be transformed by God, to think of Paul's categories in Romans 12. Not being conformed to the world, but being transformed by God in the world. In other words, two ways of being worldly. First, you could fail to be like salt, and you could be salt that had lost its taste. It wasn't salty, so it was useless for all the things that salt was used for. And Jesus is but what is Jesus actually warning against? And I think, given the literal description there, he was warning them to resist the pressure to just blend in to the surrounding society, even though the surrounding society is very, very threatening to them. They're a tiny minority here, really small minority. Here, it's at the very beginning of his ministry, so he's got scarcely any followers even. They're a tiny minority within Israel, And within Israel, a far greater minority within, rather even smaller minority, that's what I'm trying to say, within the Roman Empire. But he warns them of being controlled by the desire to blend in and be diluted and compromised to become resonant with the culture rather than dissonant into the culture. A powerful incentive to adapt, to accommodate, and to assimilate into a wider culture, and so, obviously, have less conflict with it. Get along fine. Get along well with everybody, without dissonance, without saltiness. Now, that's... this is the people of God being like a chameleon, basically, which adjusts itself by changing color to whatever it happens to be standing on or sitting on. Whatever color is dominant in the surroundings, the chameleon can adapt itself and blend in with camouflage, as it were. We can think of endless examples of this pattern working out in among Christians in the history of the church. A pattern of compromise with the world around the Christian. It means the Christians throw out particularly difficult Christian teachings, ethics, which are unpopular or offensive in the wider culture, such as about God, truth, power, sin, sex, money, and then they outgrow them and leave them behind and then blend in. Some whole groups of churches do this by, there's a catastrophic slogan promulgated by the... on purpose by the World Council of Churches, saying the world sets the agenda for the church. That's their self-identity. The world sets the agenda for the church. That means we're not doing anything else into the world. We're looking, what's happening in the world, and we'll rush to get there in time. And that's just exactly what Jesus is arguing against here, is letting the non-Christian world set your agenda for you. When I have a lot for you to do, I rely on some non-Christians here to make this more down to earth. One of my favorite examples of a lot of things is Doonesbury cartoons. And this is an example of some of you maybe heard me use this before, a pastor interviewing two people thinking of joining his church, okay? This is the little church at Walden. And the pastor, this poor guy, Mike, who's the pastor there, and this couple comes to him wanting to think about joining the church. So what would you like to know about Little Church of Walden, folks? Don't hold back. I know how difficult it can be to choose a church. Well, what's your basic approach here, Reverend? Is it traditional gospel? In a way, I like to describe it as 12-step Christianity. Basically, I believe that we're all recovering sinners. My ministry is about overcoming denial. It's about recommitment, about redemption. It's all in the brochure there. Wait a minute. Sinners? Redemption? Doesn't that imply guilt? Well, yes, I do rely on the occasional disincentive to keep the flock from going astray. Guilt's part of that. And this is the husband says, I don't know. There's so much negativity in the world as it is. And wife, that's right. We're looking for a church that's supportive, a place where we can feel good about ourselves. I'm not sure the guilt thing works for us. Husband, on the other hand, you do offer a racquetball. Wife, so do the Unitarians, honey. Let's shop around some more. Well, you know, here's Gary Trudeau, not a Christian, but what's he doing? He's looking at the Christian church from the outside and mocking its total sellout of its birthright. And he's just mocking it. He's finding it laughable, and it is laughable. Another variation on that theme is a piece by Garrison Keillor. Well, I'm not sure where he's coming from. He's a theist, for sure. This is kind of a satire by him. It's called The Current Crisis in Remorse. It's from an article called The Current Crisis in Remorse. He's mocking the way everybody's given up on sin and evil. And... This is satire. This is not this is not historical reporting. In 1976, a major Protestant denomination narrowly defeated an attempt to destigmatize the prayer of confession by removing from it all guilt or guilt-oriented references. Lord, as we approach thy throne of grace, having committed acts which we do heartily acknowledge must be very difficult for thee to understand. Nevertheless, we do beseech thee to postpone judgment and to give faith, thy faithful servants the benefit of the doubt until such time as we are able to answer all that thy questions fully and clear up all thy doubts. And he goes on. Now, you know, this is, again, this is, I think, some people from outside the church looking at the church and saying, what are they doing? What are they doing? But this is, a loss of distinctiveness on things that are really critical for our own identity. It's one kind of worldliness to get your security from within this world. It's a kind of social security, security from establishing social unity within the world that you achieve by a lack of conflict with the world because you fit right in. But then there's an equal and opposite kind of failure. I've been talking about the saltless salt, an equal and opposite kind of failure, which is Jesus' other warning, is that we be like light under a bushel basket. What does that mean? This is light that can't shine out. It's light enough to illuminate the whole house, but it doesn't get out of the basket. It just heats up the basket, where it's trapped inside. This is the opposite kind of response to the pain of being in a minority situation. It's to hold tight and hard to doctrines of the faith, ethics of the faith, to resist compromise staunchly, to not bend an inch, but to retreat into a tribal Christian subculture as we do that. And behind a fortress wall, form a quarantined Christian ghetto. Now, within those walls, people almost always begin to speak in what I would call a tribal Christian dialect. So they speak Christian in a way that people who are not Christians at all may not even understand what's going on, what they're trying to say. They read tribal Christian books, listening to tribal Christian music, but are very right and very spiritual and very good and very upright and very safe. Now, this, what I call the saltless salt, the chameleon syndrome, I call this the muskox syndrome, because a muskox is a wonderful Arctic animal that when they're threatened by a predator, they form a circle with the young or the wounded or something inside the circle, and they all face out with whacking big horns, looking out at wolves or whatever predators there are. And you don't mess with, nobody messes with them. Wolves don't mess with them or anything. Forming this circle and just looking out with formidable horns. They would be a better example of what I'm trying to illustrate, the Christian tribal subculture, if they faced inwards and just gave the occasional blind kick at the threatening world out behind them, which they don't bother to look at. The tribal Christian group will always need more rules than the New Testament allows you or gives you, because you need to create a solidarity in the tribe and a sense of the need to stay close to the tribe to maintain your identity. It's usually a place for legalism to flourish, for rules to multiply, for the sake of safety. For example, there are Christian schools which teach literature, but which forbid the reading of both Shakespeare and Dickens because they were not born-again Christians. And we want a safe environment to raise our children in. There are at least two styles of the muskox syndrome. Actually, there's many of both of these, but I'll just mention two because they're quite distinct from each other. There's one that lies low and doesn't raise its head except occasionally and keeps safe. I gave this talk once to, a college somewhere in the Midwest, the faculty there, and one guy said, I want to add to your animals. One of the, what you've described here is the prairie dog who barks once and then goes to ground. And so maybe this is the, This is the variation on the muskox who barks once and then goes to ground and doesn't want to lift his head above the ground after that. So basically for lying low, occasionally stick up your head, but basically lie low and not create any sense of difference. But then there's also within what I'm calling the muskox syndrome, there's the very active belligerent stance, which openly confronts the non-Christian world, but all in Christian language and in Christian categories, and doing nothing to make those categories make sense to the non-Christian world that they're speaking to. So not trying to see how the world feels or looks to the non-Christian people that they're trying to to talk to. Chameleon and muskox syndromes are two opposite ways to be worldly. They're both getting social security rather than theological security. Security from society rather than security from God. Saltless salt, chameleons protect themselves by blending in so that there's no conflict with the world. The muskox syndrome with the light under the box protect themselves by tribalizing out so there's no contact with the world. So one has no conflict and the other has no contact. In either case, there's no real interaction or engagement. Let me just illustrate a little bit more about these two patterns, because I think they're very, very deep and they're all around us in different ways and shapes and sizes. I'll give you two examples of these happening outside the Christian church, but the same basic dynamics. Most religions, particularly in the modern secularizing world, have some equivalent to this this tension. I'll tell you a Jewish joke, because the Jewish people are so good at laughing at themselves. There are two rabbis. An Orthodox rabbi comes to a younger Reform rabbi, and the Orthodox rabbi says, "There's a boy in my congregation who says he wants a Harley for his bar mitzvah. What is a Harley?" The Reform rabbi replied, "Oh well, a Harley is a kind of motorcycle, but what's a bar mitzvah?" You see, so Judaism has just the same tension, you see, between do we stay in tune with the culture or our tradition in its depth? And apparently, at least in this, some Jewish people are frustrated that it is a choice rather than something you try and have rabbis that know about both. But it isn't easy, and Jesus never said it would be easy at all. Just as in the context where in the Christian context, Jesus echoed the call to be salt and light, so also in John's gospel, his call is to be in the world, but not of the world. It's just dealing with the same issue. You need to be in the world, but not of the world. Not flying away from the world and not belonging to the world, but somehow keeping them both together. I often, when I talk about this, think 100 years ago, large numbers of people immigrated to Boston from all sorts of places, but among them Ireland, Italy, and China. They were minorities and were treated pretty badly, as minorities often were at the time, by Bostonians. But now things are different. If you want to be in politics in Boston, it's a real good idea to have an Italian or an Irish name. In other words, they were immigrants, they were on the outside, but they're now running the show. In other words, they joined in, they blended into the society, and they're have very important roles in Boston and Massachusetts politics. On the other hand, at the same time, there was then, and still is, Chinatown in Boston. Chinese immigrants decided not to blend in. They decided that they wanted to maintain their own cultural separation and had all sorts of reasons to do that, to maintain their cultural distinctiveness and not try to blend in. And so there still is a Chinatown in Boston. Now, for racial and ethnic groups, there are very good reasons for taking both of those options. blending in or maintaining separation. Some of the parts, some of the painful parts of being a minority group can be mitigated by either of these two options. That's why these two forces are so powerful, to go one way or the other, to have a tribe or to blend in. But Jesus says, you are my church, and as my church and as my people, I don't allow you to do either of these things. Fine to do it as an ethnic group. Fine to do it as whatever. But you can't do it as the church. You can't do it as my people, because I want you to be both. I want you to be in the world but not of the world. I want you to be faithful and hold to my truth, but I want you to be in the middle of society, rubbing shoulders with people who disagree and who are not at all believers. So, in other words, he's asking us to defy two enormous social pressures if we are the church, because our identity, our social identity, is to be salt and light. He insists that even this tiny minority of his followers must defy these two enormous social pressures that could push them in either direction. And he never said it would be easy. And of course, the church has ricocheted back and forth through its history and is still doing that in all sorts of different ways. But nonetheless, the ideal is still there, that many Christians are at least driven toward. I've noticed that many people respond by reaction and go backwards into either of these options. That is, you can be so indignant about the ethical spinelessness of the chameleon that you can walk backwards into the circle of muskoxen. In other words, you can be so affronted by how ethically relativistic one group of Christians is that you can go backwards into a group that's much more, say, rule-laden than you're comfortable with. But what do? You can at least talk their language in some way. Or it can go the other way around. You can be horrified at the rigidity, at the legalism, or lack of love of Christian tribalists, and you could walk backward into a chameleon's assimilation and compromise. I find that's happening a lot. I find that with our students coming here are frustrated because they don't like either option in their own churches, not all of them at all, but feel that they've gone backwards into, without really choosing the church that they're in, but feeling uncomfortable getting into that church for some of these very reasons. They're not being a clear alternative. We can also, just to make things more complicated still, we can find that it's possible to be both chameleons and muskoxen at the same time in different areas of your life. I could go on for a long time with this, but for example, I'll just give you one example. It's possible to have high visibility Christians, say some of our televised heroes, who speak only in strict tribal Christian dialect and are so Christian and the Lord this and the Lord that and told me here, get did that and the other thing to me, who seem just so very much within the tribal Christian community, but they, in fact, many of them, or some of them at least, have blended in very nicely to the secular idolatries of sex, money, and fame. You know, all the Christian words, but have gone just right straight into swallowing whole the secular power structures. Okay, two options. This is something we talked about in a weekend we had a year and a half ago. We talked about an article in Christianity Today by Gerson and Wehner, two Washington journalists, responding to a sense that here we are, there's a certain crisis, this thing is going on around us, where do we go, where do we stand? And they contrasted, in a way that I thought was helpful, two different ways here, what they call the Wilberforce option and a Benedict option. Maybe some of you saw that article or heard us talk about it. I'll just go through both of those. The Wilberforce option, this is the option that they argue for. They are journalists in secular newspapers, after all, but Christians. Following William Wilberforce, an English Minister of Parliament who became a Christian and was a tireless defender of human dignity and rights in the late 18th and early 19th century in England, known especially for his successful fight against the slave trade that took him decades of hard work, but saw the slave trade become illegal. He was known for his battle also on all sorts of human causes for the common good, not just causes which would benefit the church directly, but a wide group of causes. Gerson and Wehner list many areas where Christian efforts have tried to underline the legitimacy of doing what he did. Be engaged, be involved in society, because you might be able to make a difference in a fruitful way. And they list all sorts of ways that Christians have made a difference in our own time. They argue hard that you should not retreat when discouraged, but keep on in your efforts to work for needed change in the public world, resisting the idea that to be Christian and to be spiritual is to live in a privatized little world of your own experience. No, we're called to get out into the wider public world. They think that the efforts of the Christian right to apply electoral force from the top down, getting Christians elected into public office and then passing correct laws to transform society in a Christian direction, has been a failure that was misconceived from the start. But that doesn't mean that we should withdraw from public life itself as the answer. So they say that we should not be discouraged and withdraw. They cite many ways in which significant issues in society have become better in the last 20 or 30 years. And this, frankly, one doesn't necessarily hear about very much. He says there's significantly fewer abortions, fewer divorces, lower percentage of teens having sex, lower homicide rates. Christian efforts have been effective in raising the visibility of sexual trafficking globally, pressing for funding for AIDS treatment in Africa, criminal justice reform, and fostering and adopting children. They think all these things have been moving in a helpful direction, and they point out Christians very actively involved in every one of those. And so don't get discouraged as if everything is useless, but keep on. Then they contrast that with the Benedict option. The Benedict option coming from Benedict of Nursia, having lived from AD 840 to 547, excuse me, AD 480 to 547, who started a number of monasteries to create sort of oases of Christian life and understanding in the midst of the growing corruption and barbarity of the Roman Empire. He is known for his Rule of Saint Benedict, which was his guide for how to run such a community. And the Benedictine monasteries ended up having a huge impact on the shape of the medieval society because they sent people out and they developed a Christian way of life which was really hammered out with biblical principles. The term the Benedict option was coined by a contemporary Christian journalist and author, Rod Dreher. He got the idea from the last paragraph in a book by Alistair MacIntyre, which I will read to you, not the book, but the last paragraph, or some of the last paragraph. It's called After Virtue, a very well-known book in some circles. A philosopher with very real Christian leanings. He basically spends the book showing the lack of ethical underpinnings there are in Western culture and how much we've lost what we need to really behave ethically and have that ethical behavior be something that's powerfully active in society. He ends the whole thing comparing us to our present situation with the Roman Empire. Crucial turning point in that earlier history occurred when men and women of goodwill turned aside from the task of shoring up the Roman Empire and ceased to identify the continuation of civility and moral community within the maintenance of that empire. What they set themselves to achieve instead, often not recognizing fully what they were doing, was the construction of new forms of community within which the moral life could be sustained, so that both morality and civility might survive the coming ages of barbarism and darkness. In my account of our moral condition, if my account of our moral condition is correct, we ought also to conclude that for some time now, we too have reached a turning point. What matters at this stage is the construction of local forms of community within which civility and intellectual and moral life can be sustained through new dark ages which are already upon us. And if the tradition of the virtues was able to survive the horrors of the last dark ages, we are not entirely without grounds for hope. This time, however, the barbarians are not waiting beyond the frontiers. They have already been governing us for quite some time, and it is our lack of consciousness of this that constitutes part of our predicament. We are waiting not for a Godot, but for another, doubtless very different, Saint Benedict. Well, a lot of people have picked up that passage, and Rod Dreher running with it, and saying that this is, ought to have huge implications for us as Christian people. He sees hope in local communities who understand the state of the world, which can hold to Christian truth and enable it to Christian truth and virtue to flourish despite the darkness of the barbarity around us, outside society. He sees Benedictine monasteries as not something to reproduce, but a very, very loose model in terms of how they functioned. Now, Rod Dreher has picked up that reference and written on the Benedict option. I think he's got a book coming out sometime this winter on it, which will be interesting. As an alternative to Christian investing's great hope, Christians investing great hope in their ability to transform society, American or European society, from within, he says, no, it's too far gone. We need to form communities and build our confidence in the communities that we can form that are inside that culture. He doesn't disagree entirely with the Wilberforce option, but he says there's a more radical change is needed, or we will be swept away by the river of the power of the secular culture and its lack of grounding in moral reality. We will lose our Christian identity, our saltiness, and our light, and our children. There's no use pretending we can have a significant political influence, he says. We should back off all political ambitions. We need to find new ways to build communities where we can bind ourselves to Scripture and our own theology and to each other, not just for survival, but to be able to be salt and light into the darkness. In his words, Christians need to build resilient communities within our condition of internal exile. Now, as I think of these two options, the Wilberforce option, the Benedict option, I frankly really don't want to choose between them. I really feel very uncomfortable with the implications of choosing between them. The liabilities of both standing alone, the Wilberforce option, if without being grounded in solid communities of faith, of belief, of community commitment to one another and accountability, the danger would be, and I think we've seen this already, to not be careful enough to avoid the chameleon syndrome, blending in, being saltless salt in your effort to change it, and working shoulder to shoulder with this secular and pluralistic society. It's easy to begin to see things their way because they are bright people, they're nice people, and they make a lot of sense. And have the Benedict option here too. The danger is in the other direction. The Benedict option may produce communities which become tribal communities if they're not attuned to avoid really this muskoxen syndrome, light under a box. These communities become so overwhelmed with the evil out there and our role in preserving safety ourselves against the outside barbarity that we can easily become an isolated community. I think of a lecture I did years ago called The Danger of Safety. And safety is very dangerous if we have the wrong handle on it. There's nothing safe about just safety itself. Taking, let's say, the most conservative option among any options that are available to you. That's not safe. Nothing safe about that. Being more conservative than Jesus was, for example. More prohibitive than what Jesus was. or the New Testament is. That the Benedict option, again, can easily miss out on and not take up possibilities for cooperation with the non-Christian world in ways that could be exactly what's needed to be salt and light. Engagement with our culture. I use engagement because some Christians are very worried about the term transform the culture because they think it shows arrogance and the illusions of our own power that we'll go out and transform the culture and do this, that, or the other thing. And that's true. That can be a really arrogant attitude. I'm not so worried about the term. I'm very worried about the arrogance. But I don't think arrogance rides on the term necessarily. But we're called to engage our culture in any case as salt and light. Whether we end up transforming it for good will be up to God himself. I'll look at engagement past, present, and future. Here I feel a little bit like Dickens' ghost of Christmas past, present, and future here. not quite the same. To look at the past here, recent past. Some powerful movements in 20th century America, which I think are instructive. Civil rights, the sexual revolution, anti-war movement against Vietnam, environmental movement, and feminism. Hugely powerful movements in America in the 20th century. Each of these produced major changes in law and public policy, as well as in all sorts of people's attitudes. None of them started with politics. They started with people's minds, attitudes, feelings, and habits being changed through cultural persuasion, direct and indirect. That means through the channels of the institution of culture making, of journalism, of higher education, of the media, music, film, TV, publishing, anything to do with storytelling. How people thought, felt, and acted about race, sex, war, and women in society changed. At that point, political and legal changes were inevitable. So we see what I'm saying. Those cultural change from all sorts of different aspects of culture and sizes and shapes and channels, which then brought about the political change. Interesting to contrast that to the sort of Christian American story in the 20th century. Here again, these are both super collapsed to illustrate my point. Early 20th century, high visibility battles in Protestant churches between modernism and the more evangelical, became known as fundamentalist, our churches, which were very public events. Front page of the New York Times would have to do with what's going on within the Presbyterian Church or whatever. That goes up right into the 1920s. Then you have the Scopes Trial, 1925. Which was, I don't want to get into it, but it was a tremendous public shaming of Bible-believing Christians. William Jennings Bryan being mocked, and Clarence Darrow making sure that all Bible-believing Christians should be mocked with him. And a tremendously influential event, actually, because of the sort of shame poured on Christians who believe the Bible, who were revealed to be absolute backwoods hicks and nothing more going to them than that. And that's what they always were and always will be, so you can forget about them and not pay any attention, which most of American society did. Forget about them. We don't need to pay attention. They're dead now. They're dead in the water. Now, in fact, they weren't dead in the water. They formed schools, colleges, Bible colleges, radio stations, but all serving the evangelical community. You get to World War II and after, and then you start to have some Christians, some evangelical Christians, say, wait a minute, we've turned our back on much of American culture, and it has gone way on beyond us, and we have no touchstone in it. And that is a very bad mistake. We want to reconnect with modern culture. And Christians were there when Billy Graham started to pull audiences of 100,000 people. Journalists went berserk. They say, what? Where do these people come from? They were meant to have disappeared in 1925. So they were utterly amazed that these people had been hiding all the time, all this time, but were out of their vision. Now, what happened then in the late 40s, 50s, into the 60s is a group of Christians, of which Schaeffer was one, trying to bring culture back into the Christian perspective and the Christian perspective into culture by doing catch-up, which Princeton Seminary had been a place where some of this was being done, but a few other places, but not enough to really to keep us evangelicals abreast of what's going on. So we had turned our back on the culture-making institutions like journalism, higher education, media, the arts, and so on. And starting from this time, we had and we still have a lot of catch-up to do. But by the time you get to the 70s, when this is just beginning, you have the Christian right come in with a political message and try to go straight to politics without touching all the different cultural avenues that one would need to do to make the political message believable. And trying to elect Christians an evangelical voting bloc to get evangelical legislation passed or legislation pleasing to us passed and change the nation. Well, it didn't happen. But perhaps this, I give you this bit on the past to say this is really something we've got to live down and leave behind us, and if we are involved politically, we must not make this mistake again. We must be involved in cultural persuasion, which is much harder, much slower, but which may have to precede our attempts to change, for example, legislature. The moral framework of the Christian faith must be presented and understood to be something that represents the common good and be in some ways attractive to our neighbors, rather than just be something that is stuck down their throats by a voting bloc. Shifting to the present. If we're involved politically, we must not be preoccupied only with political issues which are our own issues, dealing with, say, the rights and freedoms of Christians or prayer in public schools. We must have a wider grasp on our attempt to influence the public good, because we've got a huge, given the justice of God, we've got a huge repertoire of areas which we can be under him, faithfully to him, active in. For example, the prophets, when you see them evaluate a nation or a part of society, what's the first thing they ask about? It's what's happening to the poor? What's happening to the widow and the fatherless in this society? So just an immediate reflex response. How does God check out a society? The first question God asks is, how are they dealing with the poor? Now, that's not what Christians have been doing, or not what they're known for. Some Christians have in ways that are wonderful. But we need a wider framework. There are many areas of human dignity that are under attack, which need our thinking, attention, work, activism, social, economic, educational, racial justice, environmental issues. Wilberforce was an extraordinary example of this. He's associated with the slavery issue, which he put an enormous amount of energy behind. But he was also very involved in Africa, involved in India, in the sort of colonial, sort of trying to regulate and have a Christian conscience on colonial efforts, on economic justice at home, on cruelty to all sorts of groups, to children, to women. He was involved in several animals' rights or animal cruelty animals organizations against gambling, against the lottery. When he died, they found that he had been involved in over 100 organizations in England to change things, the Manner and Morals of England, and quite a few of those he had started himself. The point is that we need to be moved by injustice to correct those wrongs wherever it is, not just when our immediate interests as evangelical Christians seem to be in danger or at stake. And that will have a lot to do with how we are perceived, whether we're working really for the common good, and so should be taken seriously, or whether we're just working for our own interests, like any other interest group that's out there, and so dismissed as just another interest group. I find it's intriguing. Francis Schaeffer used to teach about political involvement. We must be able to work with co-belligerents who are not necessarily our allies. That was co-belligerents but not allies was his sort of mantra here that he hammered on again and again as he became more politically involved. Now, what that meant was that you need to be willing to work with people on certain issues that where you agree with them, but who don't agree with you on anything else. They don't even agree with you on why you're involved in this issue. You may not agree with them about anything else, but you agree with this issue, roll up your sleeves and get to work with them on this issue. And it'll expand your world. Democratic government is not the church, and we shouldn't pretend that it is the church. If we are to be salt and light, we need to look intentionally to see issues where we can stand with those who aren't Christians and on issues that they care about that are also our issues or ought to be our issues. In our rhetoric, we need to use a minimal amount of Christian or religious language if we want to be persuasive. We can be catastrophically predictable in the way we speak. We need to break that somehow and be more unpredictable when we speak specifically even of Christian subjects. You could think of someone like C.S. Lewis who 60 years after he's died almost, and he's still one of the most effective apologists into today's society right now because he really leaned over backwards to get to free himself from religious language. That's one of the reasons, but a big reason. And so what he said was fresh. It came in angles that were fresh to people. Okay, past, present, future. I'm out on thin ice here a bit. I'm not a fan of futurology, but I've been reading a fascinating book by an Israeli historian, Yuval Noah Harari. It's called Homo Deus, which just means man-god. The subtitle is A Brief History of Tomorrow. So you can tell he's out there spinning out things into the future. I want to throw out some of his predictions into our discussion because there's likely some truth to some of them, enough so that I think it helps us in our topic tonight. I will, by the way, on the weekend we're having on February 18th, I'm going to be talking much more about him because some of his ideas are really, really interesting. he's looking at today but also into the future. One of his main points is that consciousness and intelligence are now separated. What he means is that a computer can crunch zillions of numbers that would take lifetimes of human being to do, but it can also beat all the grandmasters at chess, which is not just number crunching. It's something much more human-like of reasoning and so on than just crunching numbers. We are conscious. The computer is not conscious. But the computer can outdo us in all sorts of, in more and more things that we take to be distinctively human or depend on consciousness. it can do a lot of things that we better than we can, not just crunch numbers. As he points out, an autonomous car may soon be able to drive better than we can without feeling anything or having any desires. What value is consciousness? With people who are conscious, we have to let them have paid vacations, we have to pay health benefits, we have to pay their retirement with a robot, with a machine. No worries of all that stuff. You can amortize the investment. and save money. Given the growth of automation and robotics, most human beings are losing their usefulness, he says, and so the economic and political system will stop attaching very much value to them. By the year 2050, 60% of our population will be economically and politically irrelevant, he says. I think that means also unemployed. 60% of the population. But we see something. I mean, it's not that one of the reasons Mr. Trump was inaugurated today has to do with lost jobs, which aren't just exported to the global community, but to due to automation. And who hasn't just driven on the Mass Pike recently and found there's nobody who takes your money anymore? And it actually, nice. The traffic moves better. Traffic moves easier, not having people taking your money. So I think this is the kind of thing that's incremental, but I'm not all saying what he's saying is going to happen. But hey, this is going on in a way that I think we need to really think about. He sees that liberal humanism, what he calls liberal humanism, has overcome and surpassed religion, traditional religions, in their providing a driving force to us. But liberal humanism is going to be, and I don't have time to get into this, is getting destroyed by its own technology. And what he means by that is that science and technology is reducing to liberal humanism being all about human freedom and self-expression and so on, but is destroying the idea of human freedom. We are programmed, he says, out of a cake. The scientist, half the cake is randomness. The other half the cake is complete determinism. There are no crumbs left for human freedom, he's saying. No crumbs left for human freedom. So replacing that will be, well, I'll give you one more thing from liberal humanism. He's saying it has made the choice to trade meaning for power. Meaning of human, because meaning is given by God, who's created us, and we're meaningful in terms of our relationship to God. We've traded that away for power, of knowledge of science, to reduce that reduces human beings to just material, a material phenomenon. And so the power of that has produced this exchange, throwing meaning away for the power of scientific understanding and reduction, basically what we call scientific reductionism, and explaining people entirely on the basis of biochemistry or whatever. And he says that's going to come back and destroy, it is the process of destroying liberal humanism. We're going to be left with techno-humanism, which he sees is coming out of medicine and brain science, whose cutting edge will be less healing, I'm thinking of medicine here, less healing and more enhancement. Okay, because we've dealt with most of the main plagues and diseases, and medicine is going to be dealing much more with enhancement. How can we make a better human being? Through nanotechnology, genetic enhancement, and brain/computer interface. The challenge will be to get humans as close to God as they can. As we can get them, seeing mortality as something to be overcome. Remember, the name of his book is Homo Deus, Man God, and that's because that's what he sees coming: is that we will that becoming God is really what we're going to be after we've as we get really in gear in the later part of this century. So one alternate is techno-humanism, which is all into enhancement and making a supreme human being and eventually actually overcoming death. And then the other form of humanism is what he calls data religion. Data will know so much more about us than we know about ourselves that data will be seen as God. It will know more about what we feel than we do, and we'll be able to guide, and we will look to data to guide our choices far more than any other authority or source that's around us. Few people, of course, will need to understand and write the algorithms for this, but the rest of us will be following along. Now, he then says, traditional Christianity will still be around, but it will be a rear guard operation. It will be a rear guard operation. In other words, it'll be just helping people hold life together who have trouble with these things happening. And will, unlike what the Christian faith was in the 17th century, it was a driving force behind science, and the 18th, 19th century, a driving force behind democracy. But it'll be not a driving force behind anything, but just hanging on to some sort of self-maintenance. Now, I have no idea of the accuracy of these predictions. I haven't spoken them because I'm convinced that they're true. And yet there's a certain continuity there between what we see now and what he's describing, particularly if we're more attuned to what's going on in Silicon Valley and what's coming out of there in terms of expectations. All I've told you about his ideas point to, and this is a key thing, I think, point to a massive problem of elitism coming at us in the future. A loss of the intrinsic dignity of every person. If he's saying anything that's right, this is going to be happening. A huge problem of the every man created equal in our declaration. This is going to be very, very much under fire. Already, this 2016, there's 62 billionaires, you've probably heard this, there's 62 billionaires in the world who own more than the bottom 50% of the entire world population. Medical enhancement in all its forms will be surely only for the rich and powerful. What's that going to do to have certain people, classes, a caste of people who really will be genetically different? Whether they carry computers in there, interacting with their brains or not, or whatever. But that's going to be a huge separator of people from each other. I see all sorts of pushback from this, against these directions, and I think it will be very... I'm mentioning this not just to lay these ideas out for themselves, but to look at the future ourselves and say, if we want to be involved, what are some of the key areas of the Christian faith that are going to be under fire, and that at the same time, maybe things we need to be in there doing very creative thinking, acting, building with. Because these sorts of changes on human population are going to create a lot of human pushback against them, because humans are human beings and made in the image of God and are not made to be plowed under in ways that are implicit here. I've no time to go into these, but I'll just give you a quick run through of things that have struck me. We'll need to give real importance to Christian teaching and wrestling with the truth and the depth of issues like meaning, the meaning of life. Because this is gone already, basically, but there's huge pushback against this. Some of you have listened to me lecture on it here. If you ask what's the meaning of life, to most people, certainly under 50, they think you've just cracked a joke, and because what a ridiculous question, the meaning of life. And yet, those same people want everything that they care about in their lives to be meaningful. They want meaningful marriages, meaningful educations, meaningful work, meaningful house to live, meaningful everything they do that they care about, they will want to be meaningful. So there's huge pushback here, and that's a huge occasion for us. How can we talk about that in a way that's really constructive? Massive, massive issue implicit in what I've said is human dignity and equality. Human dignity and equality are not grounded in any measurement of people one to the other. People, if you measure them in any measurable criterion, are not at all equal to each other. If we measure everybody in this room by any criterion you can ever imagine, we'll all be different. We'll all measure differently. Height, weight, IQ, artistic ability, musical ability, ability to jump, to walk on their hands, we'll be unlike each other. You can never ground belief in human equality on anything measurable that we can get our hands on or observe or anything like this. And again, I've lectured on this a lot before, but it comes from only one place, which is the first chapter of Genesis, and the enormous, enormous cultural power that human beings made in the image of God and precious to God have in the book of Genesis on and all the way through the whole rest of the scriptures. Tremendous power, cultural power, coming, flowering later, gradually in the Middle Ages, and then flowering much more after the Reformation and the expansion in the rest of Europe. But overcoming caste systems, overcoming aristocracies, where what was important was not each individual as they stand before God, but families, aristocracies that were important, and nothing else was. So huge issue. We have a whole other, in what I've described to you, a threat of a huge aristocracy that could be formed around these changes. Work. Think of what work will mean. We've got to do some really interesting thinking about work as we see things change, as we see things develop. How do we understand work? Family. Imagine what will happen to the family under stress in these ways. The environment, clearly. And as I'll talk a little bit more of in a second, community. Because community is so important in terms of the grounding of people together to face any threat, to face any set of changes. It could be the Christian faith is not at all a rearguard operation by the middle of this century or the end of this century, but plunk in the middle of all sorts of battles that are over vital Christian teachings. If we've got our heads screwed on and are listening and trying to make sense of our world. But I wanted to talk about community here because that's the vital importance of the Benedict option. I'm not choosing between these two, but I think we need to appreciate the strength of the Benedict option as something that we need to really take seriously. It recognizes the need for community, especially in time of stress, persecution, struggle. It's not and never will be a time for there never will be a time for Christian lone rangers. Unless we stand together, we may not stand at all. And the human, it's not only just a human need, but it ought to be the special characteristic of the body of Christ. Think of how Paul describes the body of Christ, parts of the body of Christ, needing it and depending on each other. The purpose of Christian community is to be both to strengthen us in that community, in our own faith, in our care for each other, in our awareness of our own history. And I know of so few Christian groups or communities or churches that make an effort to understand our own Christian history, what is happening around us right now, what that means, how that interacts with our theology, with our ethics at a deep level, and what is it to live this out together in prayer, in support, in teaching, in accountability, in worship. The church needs not just converts, but it needs disciples, meaning apprentices of Christ, not just people who have converted to Christ, but people who are apprentices of Jesus Christ. But it's also to encourage us and equip us to look out, to read out, to live out into the world outside the Christian community. A Christian community doesn't need to be a tribal community. Shouldn't be a tribal community. A Christian community can provide great incentive and impetus to reach out. It's ironic to me that the opposition of Wilberforce and Benedict options is the way it's been framed by these two journalists, because Wilberforce was totally dependent on a Benedict-type local community. A very intentional community of faith, the Clapham group or sect in London, as they were called. His accomplishments could never have been accomplished without this group of people who were really his center. It ran from 1790 to 1830, meeting twice a week for worship, for prayer, for discussion, based in a local church in the south of London. What he had was closer to a Benedict Benedictine monastery than what most of us will ever experience. And yet we take him as sort of the model of the one who's out there and just engaging to change society. Yes, he was, but not alone at all. There were 15 families and a number of single people. Some of them were wealthy and well-connected, and they used that wealth and that well-connectedness to get at all sorts of different sides of Christian, of non-Christian English society. They exploited their privilege to really make it work under God. You see there a great strength in this group of Christians that were together and did much more than they ever could have done, any of them separately. And he was the first to admit this himself, because he had people doing research for him, investigating for him, all sorts of connections politically, and so forth. Well, finally, in all this, God is our security. Our security is not a social security from getting on nicely with the larger environment, nor is it from getting on only with people just like us, people who laugh at our jokes. These two enormous pressures on us to tribalize or to compromise keep us from our true identity as salt and light. I've described both of them as worldliness, getting security from the world, not from God. Anything better must be better because it's trusting in God, stepping out as salt and light. This is how God works. We're called not necessarily to win, but to be faithful each day. None of us will be able to say what the results of our efforts are at any level of our lives, what the results will be in the kingdom of God. It could be that we'll bring great things, which we don't even know in this life, or great things that we somehow are able to recognize while we're still living here. It could be that our efforts only slow down the decay of our culture. It could perfectly well be that during the years of our that we have on Earth, but will be very much worth doing. I love a saying by Reinhold Niebuhr that nothing that is worth doing could be achieved in our lifetime. Now that's ought to be a humbling thing. He's worth doing in a big framework. He says, God is in this for the long haul. We are impatient for the results, for results, and maybe wanting a brass plaque to put on our achievements. God is the Lord of all history. As we trust him, he will enable each of us to be fruitful, to bear fruit, which will have eternal significance. Jesus taught us to be salt of the earth and light of the world. He said, let your light shine before others so that they may see your good works and give glory to your Father in heaven. I will stop there. And over to you. Yes?
So is it too reductionist or simplistic or churchy even to say that transformation of society, or maybe it's even just given or understood in the backdrop of your speech, that the gospel really is the only thing that transforms society, and that, just like you said, the Christian right skipped over cultural pathways to hit political directly. If we try to transform cultural pathways, but we skip over the gospel, and then we just making society more just and fair and good, but still on the way to hell.
Mm-hmm. I think we've got to do it all, and yet, I mean that's a hard question in a way, because how. If any Christian in politics, for example, are they going to feel they need to make an evangelistic appeal every part of every speech they make? You know, I don't think so, and I don't think that's what you say is true. Well, it's not true that no change can happen without the actual gospel. Changes can happen for better, for justice, with no Christian hands laid on them at all. and others can happen with Christian hands laid on them without it being attached to a big evangelistic approach. Obviously, if things are going to, if we believe the gospel, we want that to be a piece of it, that we want that to be there. So we're not offering a hope in just a humanistic rearrangement of the decks on the Titanic, the chair deck chairs on the Titanic. And so we'll want that to be the case. But I think we can't afford to wear that on our foreheads as we're trying to do social change. We need to be willing to work in the world to better people's lives, whether they become Christians or not. We want them to become Christians, of course we do. But it's worth working for justice whether the people become Christians or not. And otherwise, I think it can become a very... Evangelism is the only thing that's worth doing. And you see Christians engaged with non-Christian people only to do evangelism with them, to them. I, for example, know people who, in their work, only have a job and go to it to be in it because it's an occasion for evangelism. Now, in fact, they become a menace and often lose their jobs because they're not there to do a good job, and the evangelism gets in the way of doing a good job. So I think the relationship is going to be very, very tricky, and it's going to be very much individually worked out according to our temperaments and also because what sort of a track we're taking in life. But I think you're right. I'm assuming, in the whole talk, I'm assuming that we believe the gospel and want more than just evangelism to take place. We want the care that we have or ought to have for justice in the world as well to be felt, and it hasn't been felt as much as it should be. We need to care about the environment as well, God's world, which isn't an evangelistic opportunity as such, but is something that matters before God. So, yeah, it's very hard to answer that in general because that's so specifically personal, I think, in terms of what sort of a situation are we talking about? What sort of a life situation are we dealing with?
But you're still saying that the gospel should be something we bring with us as a main part of what we're doing, not that we just say, well, it's nice if we can work it in, but let's work to better society.
Yeah, definitely. But that how we introduce the gospel and put that together with our cultural endeavor is something I really don't want to dictate.
Yeah.
I don't want to dictate.
Okay.
Yeah. Any other? Yes.
How does the church ever get mobilized to even put engagement on the priority list? If most churches are either
Muskrat might be another one. There might be a pattern that we can call the Muskrat.
Totally assimilated. I mean,
Muskrat Ramble.
So you know that middle ground, right? Like you have pockets of parachurch ministries that think this is important. How, as a whole, does the church ever get mobilized to? Like I try to think of this problem. You know, we've been to so many different churches. I'm like, do you educate the pastors? Do you educate the next generation? I mean, where does that happen? And how do people even start valuing this enough to start living by it?
You've got to start somewhere.
Yeah.
You try and find a few people of like mind.
Yeah.
And we're ahead of where we used to be. That ought to encourage you a little bit.
Wait, what do you mean by that?
I mean that you look at Christian colleges and seminaries, and this is more on their page, in their minds and in their curricula now. There's an enormous amount more published about it now. churches are very different in terms of how much they're, what sort of watershed they're in terms of information and so on. But like Gordon Conwell has a whole professorship that's dealing with the business world, the corporate world, and how do we help people know how to relate to the corporate world. And a lot of people go who aren't going to go into the ministry but want to go into the corporate world as really informed Christians. So I think we're a long ways ahead where we used to be. But the great danger is that we'll swallow where the secular world wants us to stay, which is that spirituality is private. Mm-hmm. It's all you and God. And the public world is, I mean, as a famous book was written, the naked public square. The public square is naked. It has no worldview. It's just objective out there. There's no religion. There's no worldview or anything that has anything to do with it. It's just normal, objective, or whatever, which, of course, is completely false because it has all sorts of non-Christian ideas floating around. But we have to be able to say, no, we want the public world to have a Christian voice there because we have every right to give a Christian voice there, and we're moving in that direction. It's slow, but it's of course, I don't know what churches you've tried and so on, but the church has been extremely involved. You know, you think of Park Street Church here in Boston, they were very involved in the abolitionist movement and had real leadership there. So the evangelical church has had a history of getting on board with things like this that are really, really important. And so I think we need to be patient and need to find some people of like mind and keep pushing. But another thing is what's where the church is, what's going on, what are there issues of justice, need, and so on that the church could step into, could do something about. People who need help, people who need encouragement, people who need things built for them, or whatever. I mean, there's a lot to be done if we look around, which I think can do wonders for a church, for the life of a church too, as a functioning body of Christ. But to find churches where, I mean, the good thing is that there are a lot of evangelical churches doing things. When I first became a Christian, which was in the mid-60s, it was only liberal churches that were involved in doing anything to do with social justice at all, or race, or anything. It's just not at all true now. And so this, things are moving. Jenny?
You came to one point kind of like a hybrid that Wilberforce represented as like in his private life being involved in his community and in his public life doing a more maybe individualistic mission, if that's fair to say.
I was rather saying that the two are totally interdependent.
Yeah.
He was able to do his public ministry because he had so much support.
Do you think that that is a unique situation, or is that maybe a blueprint on which to work in the future?
I want to say definitely the latter.
Yeah.
Why in the world not? Well, I'm hungry for Labrie being closer to that itself. And we're too far apart from one another, many of us, because we're in different continents and stuff like this. But I wish we could spend more time sharing each other's work, sharing each other's projects, things we're lecturing on, what are we doing. Look at what the Inklings did, or it was C.S. Lewis's group, C.S. Lewis, Tolkien, Williams, so on, Dorothy Sayers. In their relationship to each other, we're just incredibly helpful to each other. I look at the negative side of this is a group called, as some of you who have studied literature know about, the Bloomsbury Group in London, which is a fascinating group of people who are brilliant. The really weird thing is that they were... The Clapham group all had children, who most of whom were not evangelical Christians, but who carried on a high level of social consciousness. They then had children, many of whom were the Bloomsbury Group, who were the immoralists and tried their best to shatter Victorian culture. And they were almost all bisexual and trading sexual partners back and forth and collapsing and nervous breakdowns all over the place. Individuals unable to do very much singly, but together, they did a huge amount to destroy Victorian culture in England. Some good things and some bad things to destroy. But it was their togetherness that enabled them to do extraordinary things, reviewing each other's books, starting magazines, and writing for them and each other. But we need much more of a vision of what's possible in that, because I think a great deal is possible. It has to be a long-term commitment. It can't be just occasionally meeting once in a while, but with people who of like mind, who have a like direction. I think we could do much more than we do just all alone. Yeah, Tom.
Picking up on the last two questions, one was about the how do you find a church that isn't a bunch of muskots turned into it, and the other one, your answer was about the Inklings. My personal experience with most churches is I found almost no church that is excited about helping me with find my potential, or anyone else find their potential. Far more, I find a church is a place, a social place, just like any other social place, with its own rules of conformity.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, even if the musk ox were just faced outward, that would be a star.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yep.
So I don't know what the answer is there, but the Inklings, that's who they were, right?
Lewis and Tolkien.
Yeah, right.
And
I get the idea that they took joy in each other's... I mean, they're very different writers.
Yeah.
But they took joy in each other's success, and they were helping each other.
Yeah.
And that's something... Maybe others have had other experiences, but I felt a very conforming pressure in almost any Christian social group.
Hmm.
And I don't know how that changes. I mean, I sense there's a different spirit with Brie, but nevertheless.
Yeah, well, anybody have an example of another? Yeah.
Campus ambassadors. Woo-hoo! I love it, but I'm so with you because I spent probably 20 years in church and feeling just like that I always had to become very much like them to be able to fit in. And this is a parachurch organization, we're a campus ministry organization, we're a national organization. And it's the first time I've ever worked with a group that is strength-based. They don't focus on our weaknesses.
Strength-based.
Yeah, okay. So they focus on what are your strengths? God made you. There's not shaming in the fact that you can't do certain things, even if those are good Christian things you can't do, like... Maybe you're not gifted in evangelism. Of course, we all share our faith, but maybe that's not your giftedness.
Mm-hmm.
And so we try to work to bring teams together so that it's okay that you're not the greatest evangelist. Somebody else who's good is going to come alongside. They're going to train you and help you, but it's okay, you know? And I've never had such freedom to be who God has made me to be and to not... feel that's not enough. It's really phenomenal.
What is the organization?
Campus Ambassadors. So I feel you because I've only worked with them for 6 years, and before that I've never felt this.
Now is that on a campus or campuses, or how does it relate to the?
So I work on a campus. I work at Fitchburg State.
Okay.
So we're on all different campuses, but then our areas will come together.
Is that something Tom could come to?
Come work with us, yes. then our regions come together, and then we come together nationally. Mm-hmm. And part of the way is we're a little bit like you guys, too, mm-hmm. because we're spread out. We do a lot of sharing, like our talks we can share, so we mm-hmm. have a common place. So that also helps, because we see each other's strengths.
Yep.
So that helps, too. You know?
Well, picking up on that strengths, I the church in Cambridge that... the Reservoir Church, they became, once they got a permanent place, they said, gee, well, how can we be good neighbors? And instead of looking for needs in the area, they decided to look at their own strengths. Mm-hmm. And then go to the community and say, well, we've got these strengths, and we're looking for you. And they ended up giving free soccer coaching to the kids in the neighborhood. And
Yeah, I've heard of it. Someone's written that up. Interesting
application. The whole idea of need, not need thing, not go around and see a need to go, I want to meet that, because you're not an expert at that. Mm-hmm. In other words, find something that gives you joy that you're good at. Mm-hmm. Find out if your neighbors would like you to help them out with it.
Yeah, that's interesting. Any other examples? Yes.
Dick, I was, it's not an example, but I was reading a short article last week about these new self-driving cars. Mm-hmm. And the article was making the point of when you own a self-driving car, you have to be interviewed to how you want the car to react if you're in an accident situation. If you're going down a hill and you lose your brakes, the car loses its brakes, the car has to decide, so to speak, how to react because you're not driving it. So you have to answer a couple of questions like, do you want this car to hit the elderly lady on the sidewalk on the left? Or do you want the car to hit a crowd of children that are going to school on the right?
Oh my gosh.
But we don't think about those things. And it's a short article, and I got thinking, wow, you know, how do you drive a self-driving car, and how does it decide which way to go? Not only in the sense of, I mean, it gets better traction if it goes to the left or the right. The mechanics it can figure out. But choosing which way to go, and you're the owner of this car riding in the back seat, which way does the car go? Mm-hmm. And I thought to myself, I never thought about that.
Yeah.
I mean, I threw that down the end because of the you're talking about the book, The Homeodesis.
Mm-hmm. Homeodesis.
Homeodesis. And you know, we think about these self-driving cars, how much work we can get done in the back seat. But when you have to make those sorts of decisions, you know, I never thought about it.
It sounds a little bit like something a philosopher would want to ask to bring everybody to a grinding halt.
As a question, just a comment.
But
it gets more interesting. When you're driving people to people, there's this interpersonal psychological stuff going on. And you like fake out, like if a pedestrian, like with a self-driving car, if you're a pedestrian and you know the car is self-driving, you can step in the stop walk, you can just step into the crosswalk and you know it'll stop. Mm-hmm. You don't do that with a human driver.
I'm not sure I do that. I'm not sure I do that with a self-driving car either.
But you see what I mean. You come to certain times when you fake each other out, you there's body language that you can do with your car and with your face. Which self-drivers don't have at all.
It's a wonder, because you might be able to, people might be able to tinker with the program. And no, we don't stop these people. Any other things we... Yes, Sarah.
Just came from mine, so it might be a little sloppy. But is there ever a time that it is good to be a chameleon? And I'm thinking about when Paul said, be all things to all men, and is that related at all to what you're talking about?
That's a really good thing to raise. Yes and no. That's not being a chameleon. That's Paul in an amazing way. His identity is in Christ, which means he's saying, I am free to dress anyway, it doesn't make any difference, to talk any language, to eat any food anyway, when I'm with the Romans, when I'm with the Greeks, when I'm with the Jews, to not make an obstacle there, because I by all means I want to be able to save some people with the gospel. So it's, I've got the overall drive of the gospel. That means I'm completely free on all sorts of other things that I don't care. They're negotiable for me, and I'll adjust them as I need to. So he's, it's part of saying I really know where I'm standing, which is the truth of the gospel and my task as a missionary to spread it. And if you tell me to wear purple trousers, I'll wear purple trousers if that's what I need to talk to this group of people, or wear shorts, or eat pizza or whatever. To relate to them, because I want to remove any sort of obstacle that's just a cultural obstacle, to be able to speak the gospel to them. So he's saying just all these things are negotiable, that you might stand, oh, I need to wear this sort of suit or this sort of dress or whatever, and he says no. It's the high stakes determine where I'll go on each of these issues. So it's a way of saying I'm not. It's a very good example of being salt and light, of sticking to the truth that really is solid truth that guides my behavior, and being willing to be flexible at everything else, in order to further that truth. So that's a good example. Yeah.
It actually shows that he's done the necessity of doing a lot of homework about what the different groups, what is important to the different groups that he's speaking to. So I mean, he did he studied a long time to understand. He was raised a Jew. He was a Jewish scholar, so he grew up with Judaism. He knew the law inside out. But then after he became a Christian, he went out and studied Gentile thought because God was calling him to the Gentiles, to the Greeks and the Romans. So he studied their poetry. And that statement shows that he did the necessity of doing a lot of homework to know what points of contact are important with different groups of people and what can be negotiable. So it's a really good, it's a wonderful example. And, I mean, I'll give an example in my own life and teaching. Is I've written lectures on feminism and Christianity, and I've given lectures at secular colleges on with titles like "Are Christianity and Feminism Compatible?" I've also given some of the same content at Christian conferences in the South, for example. So someone says, "Well, do you call yourself a feminist?" That title for me is totally negotiable. If I call myself a feminist in some circles, it's like the F word, the other F word. And they're going to write me off and not listen to anything I say. I want them to hear what I teach is about men and women and just what the Bible teaches about gender. So I'm not going to call myself a feminist in some circles where that will immediately turn them off, you know. Whereas in some other circles, I remember speaking at BU or speaking at Harvard or Wellesley, to call myself a feminist, that's like an oxymoron to them, and it's like, whoa, this is interesting. I think I'll go listen. because it's just so, in fact, at BU, once the title was out, there was a huge red, there was a poster with the title, "Are Christianity and Feminism Compatible?" Someone wrote oxymoron in red across the thing, but they came to the lecture. So then there's time for discussion. So, I mean, I've always taken Paul's words there as completely applying to that. The title feminism is really totally negotiable to me, depending on who I'm talking to. Mm-hmm. If it'll make somebody listen, then yeah, but I'll define it. I'll define what I mean by it. Mm-hmm. Somewhere else.
Yeah, many other things we want to raise. Yeah?
Just one random thought about what churches can be doing. Maybe just more encouragement on the part of leadership to the young people to go into a variety of vocations, I guess. Because so much, it seems that so often in churches, the church celebrates the young people who decide to be missionaries or celebrates them to a higher degree. Mm-hmm. this person grew up in the church, and look what they're doing now. Like these are the success stories.
Mm-hmm.
The youth group is just a missionary, or the pastor, or whatever it is, which are all good things, but it isn't producing a culture of salt and light. In other words, we're training you up in what is true, but you go out, you can do anything out there in the world that you're gifted at, and that isn't blatantly disobedience to God. I just feel that, if there was as much encouragement for people to go into the arts or different trades or into, as there was for more quote-unquote spiritual things, I think it would, that would be one way of very gradually changing.
Mm-hmm.
Changing the
Yeah.
But encouraging people to think of those vocations as a Christian, not just, you know, go do what you want and keep your Christian faith in your little private sphere.
That's the real killer, I think, is privatized faith, and so that it doesn't reach out. Yeah, sir.
I was just thinking that the other dynamic that I see with the, you know, the muskox thing is, you know, they may not be looking out at the world around them, but I think the dynamic that happens with churches in that way is like, they're looking over at the other group of muskox over there that are turned in, and there's a lot of the energy is in defining themselves against other groups of muskox. Mm.
Like, who are doing muskox wrong.
Kind of Christian.
What?
Right wrong.
You know, and so I think a sign of healthy churches or experiences I've had where I'm drawn to churches where I see collaboration happening with other congregations. Joshua and I have had a priest say, I don't think this is a good fit for you guys, this church. I think you should go somewhere else, you know, rather than trying to convince us why this is the right group of ox to be part of. That sense of like, we're in this together with others. That aren't under the same roof.
Yeah. And I think in community as well, there ought to be interest in each other's jobs. I mean, people are doing some really interesting things, but I mean, oftentimes don't say anything about it. Mm-hmm. But we need to be, the pastor ought to be interested in people's jobs and what's going on. How are they? What are you trying to do? Where are the battles you face? So on. So there's just so much that's, if faith is privatized, it's a very narrowing thing. Because people could think it just has nothing to do with their faith. You know, I work as an engineer, I work as a physician or something like this, and it's just nothing to do with faith. Whereas in fact, it's a huge amount and of faith issues daily, especially with the other people we work with. Yeah.
I've often wondered if the problem is the way the pastor's role is defined. I mean, the Bible says the pastor is to help, as well as the other ministries in the church, are to build up the saints to do the work of service. Mm-hmm. But pastors are experiencing burnout because they seem to think they need to teach, counsel, be the CEO. I mean, it just goes on and on and on for some pastors, and then there's just this pastor burnout. And I just wonder if they're taking on extra biblical roles, and that if there was, as you said, that kept an interest in the people. They take an interest in people. I didn't mean to say that they did, but we're taking a role that says, how can I help the members of the church do the ministries, as opposed to him doing all the ministry. It might shift the attitude more towards what Ben was saying. Of everybody has a, the pastor becomes a, the church becomes a springboard to train people to be in the world.
Yeah.
Maybe.
I think that's true. No, I think that's true. I mean, it's a huge amount needs to be done to delegate. I mean, I was a pastor for 7 or 8 years in London, and I occasionally have been tempted to, you know, from being here at LaBrie, where so many people complain about the church, tempted to think maybe God wants me to just go and be a pastor and try and do something better in a church. And then I think I would never, ever do that alone again. I would never, ever do that as just one pastor. I would do it maybe with one other person to share the load. But then it's got to be through helping to work to really spread the load in the congregation, because an enormous amount needs to be done by people in the church, because there's a huge amount to be done. Who's first? Whose hand got up first?
Simultaneous.
You pick.
Okay, go
ahead. Mine's short, though.
Okay, if you're short.
Yeah. Is it?
Okay, you go ahead.
He's my friend. I can tell her.
Okay, you go ahead.
I was just curious if you would speak out. Like, that made me think of the evangelical model of kind of having that, I lost the word, but the famous pastor, you know, the pastor becomes kind of the superstar, and we're building off of that the charisma that he has, and you know, just because it feels like that's the direction churches have gone. You know, he's supposed to put on the show and be such a great speaker.
The mega church with the mega pastor.
Yeah, exactly.
Yep.
And I feel like that does just what he said. Then it's like all eyes are on that. That's the focus. It stops being kind of down to earth and let people do the work, because you lose that being the superstar then.
And many of them can't be superstars, and it just crushes
them. Yeah, and it kills them. Yep. It kills them. But I feel like that's a much bigger thing than any particular church trying to do that.
Yep.
It's almost just the sense that we've moved ourselves into somehow.
Yep.
Which is out of total truth. Nancy Piercy's book, where she talked a little bit about that.
Yep. Okay.
Yeah, so my wife and I had a conversation the other day, and it suddenly dawned on me that we spend a huge percentage, pie chart-wise, of our free time, or not free time, but our just living time, working and parenting. But such a super small percentage of the sermons actually speak to those in a direct fashion. Why? How? Are we? I don't get that.
And you're not alone. I mean, it's most people's, but it's your parents.
Yeah, of course. I don't hear the sermons that you hear, but.
This isn't our church. This is like across the board. This is like everything we've ever visited.
Like, how many sermons on work and parenting? If you add them all up, I can put them on one hand, maybe.
But you don't need sermons on work itself and parenting itself to be relevant to your work and your parenting. I mean, some are obviously can be extremely helpful, but you know, you have a lot of.
To Tom and Ben's comments, combining those, like, there's no guidance or specificity to career or stuff like that, and there's not. Helping the details of the people in the congregation in that way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, there's so many. I mean, I just think of the personal issues involved in raising kids. Whew. Emotional issues raising kids, responsibilities. You know, there's a lot there that applies to our role as parents in the normal, call it psychology of the Christian life. Work depends a lot more on what your work is, I guess. But you still have a lot of people issues in work, or most works do anyway. There's a lot of people connection there. I can't defend sermons. No, generic as a generic category, and say they couldn't be improved, which they of course could, but it's hard to.
I mean, if preaching, where's that phrase come from? The whole counsel of God. If a church is really trying to preach through the whole of Scripture over time, I mean, it means if somebody's there for a short period of time, they're gonna miss a lot, but certainly over time. Teaching about work and parenting should be part of it, because it's covered in Scripture in a lot of.
Well, I guess that brings up the question, though: should a pastor, as a shepherd, be preaching on what his people need? Like Tom said, equipping people and building up the saints. Should he be preaching on what people need, or should he be trying to give equal weight to Genesis to Revelation, right? Mm-hmm. And then I'm only going to preach on parenting when the verse specifically talks about it, right? Because if they're going to do that, then that's what we would see. Very little preaching on parenting and work. Mm-hmm. Like, maybe we hit on it in Colossians once, you know? Mm-hmm. Let's talk about work.
Because you're supposed to obey your masters.
I think it's you could go one way or the other too far. I mean, there'll be sermons that are important for you to listen to that have nothing to do with either work or parenting. And in trying to give a, you know, in terms of what is a theology that we believe, how do we, what's going on that's important in our society? What's, you know, there's all sorts of angles that aren't specifically keyed to what your daily activities and responsibility to speak of those. I think going from Genesis to Revelation, I would never try to do that. I pick books very carefully with in mind what I think people need to hear and so forth, or passages very carefully. But there's a lot that we need to hear that we may not think we need to hear. I mean, we argue this with our students here. We have what we call discussion meals, where someone raises something and then we discuss that thing and have one conversation. Well, some topics, people come to me afterwards and can say, that was absolutely of no interest to me at all. And we spent an hour and a half on this. And I say, you know, really? Now, and I will try and say, sure, because oftentimes it's because I'm in my own head and it wasn't the thing I'm interested in, but they darn well ought to be interested in what this person who shares a bedroom with them upstairs is struggling with his or her family, with his or whatever it is. And learning to care for each other means rolling up our sleeves and trying to grapple with how things look from behind their eyes. I think it's good for us to be pushed to hear things that we're not, that aren't just up our street. Mm-hmm. That's one of the problems with the internet. We can always find something that's just up our street that I want to hear, and we're not exposed to things that as much that just cross over into our world.
So, I saw your book in the lobby before the lecture, and I originally thought that you were advocating chameleon Christianity.
Well, now you know better.
And maybe that's because I'm kind of in the midst of being a chameleon Christian at my school right now. But
I had a terrible time with the title. Yeah. If that helps, that's any help. Anyway.
Well, it had associations of being a double agent, and because I'm in the arts community, Christianity is a very delicate thing. It turns people off very quickly.
Yeah.
And Marty was saying earlier, she sometimes doesn't say the word feminism because it makes people stop listening. Is there a situation where you would not say the word Christian because it makes people stop listening?
Yep. Might well be. I would think of something else to say.
Jesus follower?
Yeah, or even avoid. Just try to talk more to the, because those are big general words. It might well be. I mean, you've got to. You don't want to mislead, but you don't want to just turn people off needlessly. I can easily imagine avoiding anything that would give things away too quickly.
Have a conversation, a lot of conversation, but around what you're doing, and especially right now, I really wouldn't use the word evangelical, that's for sure, given the connotations of evangelicalism today.
Well, depending on who you're with, but
I think I'm done with it anyway.
You know, I heard an example. I heard an Englishman who had, an older gentleman who started having revival meetings in his house and young people coming over, and a neighbor came over and said, "What is going on at your house? There's all these parties and young people. What's going on?" And he said, "You'd never believe it if I told you." And he just went over. And he did this on purpose.
Yeah.
Because he knew the culture.
Yeah.
He knew that he had a peak interest, and he just blurted it out. Yeah. This you just said, "Oh, and turn away."
Keep him in the dark for another week,
so,
at least.
Yeah, so that's just awesome. An example of working with what he knew the culture would be, because he was an Englishman himself.
That's great.
So, and that's not saying what you should do; just an example of a creative, of a thoughtful, creative avenue to increase curiosity. Yeah.
Well, doesn't the Bible say to be as cunning as serpents?
Yeah.
I always take it to mean that. You know, how can you interject the Christian ideas without all the baggage that comes, like, with the terms that goes along with it? So, I like that verse. I don't know, maybe I'm misinterpreting it.
I think that's well within the...
Well, there's missionaries to Islam that will never use the word Christian.
Mm-hmm.
They'll just talk about Jesus.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, and Islam is a huge issue of... What do you call God? And I mean, I don't know what I think about that. But it's a.
Oh.
You know, I think there's all kinds of issues like that that are. We really are interested in communicating what's true, without sending people off in some completely different direction than what we intend, just by virtue of our word choice. Yeah, Ben.
It just kind of touches on everything you've been talking about. The need to be co-belligerent with people.
Mm-hmm.
The connotation there is sort of working for some common goal that you both care about. But I mean, caring about the quality of your art and trying to be excellent in your craft, whatever that is going to be sharing a common goal with people, even if you're doing it with different motivations or if you disagree with them on everything else.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing that I think the whole co-belligerent idea is it builds or allows some trust to maybe develop, which is what isn't there when you just say, "I'm a Christian and have you heard the good news about what Jesus has done for you?"
Mm-hmm.
You automatically... There's not a context of trust there.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you've lost your opportunity to say anything of meaning to this person, but to honestly, not just as a means to the end of sharing the gospel, but to honestly love what it is you are doing and what they love doing.
Mm-hmm.
I think that is I think maybe that is that has to be the first step sometimes. And if it means not even saying anything at all about your faith, and to not feel guilty that somehow I'm chickening out or I'm ashamed of the name of Christ, but as basically a strategic thing, not just a strategic thing, because it's good to care about those. It's good to care about the quality of your art. It's good to care about say the working with some environmental organization with people who may disagree with you and all kinds of things. These are good things to care for in obedience to God, but I think the trust issue is a huge thing that I think we need to be more careful with.
Yeah, I think it relates a little bit. I mean, various times when Paul is in trial in the book of Acts, he says, "I'm here for the hope of the Pharisees," which is perfectly true.
But
he was sidestepping being pigeonholed in some little cult, a weird thing. But I'm here for the basic hope of the Pharisees, which is in the resurrection. And never mind that it was Pharisees that want his blood and would want to behead him if they had a chance. He's
very savvy.
Yeah, he knows what he's doing. And sometimes it's the start of the Sadducees and Pharisees fighting. But other times it's just to place himself in that tradition, which wasn't really the reason why he was brought up and imprisoned and so forth. But it was, but it's true. I mean, he was. His theology was Pharisee theology in the main framework of it. So, yeah.
So they brought up megapastors earlier, and I was wondering when you were going through the timeline of American evangelicalism, where would the seeker-sensitive movement fall on the spectrum? Would they fall too much into the assimilation world, or would they fall?
Probably some of each. There's certainly a lot of assimilation there. We want people to experience being in a movie theater and have everything associated with movie theater, with being in a movie theater, and sort of and make them feel at home and so forth, and give them everything that makes them feel sympathetic, order coffee during the service and whatever, which. I mean, I see that as you know, I think we need to be sensitive to seekers. I think it's a good thing to be sensitive to seekers, but it also, but not to have it push aside what we ought to be doing. So I think some places it's just to, a great effort is meant to avoid anything at all formal or anything. Like there's no call to worship or benediction. It's all just here we are, cool time. We're all dressed in cut off blue jeans and whatever, and the pastor sits on a stool or walks around. It's not that there's anything the matter with that, but you wonder if they're trying too hard to be absolutely like anything else people are involved in. Which is ironic, really, because what one of the things that draws other people to the gospel is they come into a church and it's different. There's a space of worship. They get a sense of that these people take worship of God very, very seriously, mm-hmm. and which is a tremendously powerful thing at the same time. Now, people are different, so they find maybe what they want. But I think trying to make it just cool the way everything else is in life misses out on an experience of worship that, or makes it very hard to communicate that this is actually a worship time. So I think they vary a lot. I think a lot of those churches, I think, are in the chameleon category in that they're run very often on principles of corporate marketing and principles of operation taken out of the corporate world more than out of the Bible, have measurable goals that we have to reach and ways to measure them, and we'll check and see where we are at the end of each week, each month, and so on. I listen to some of these folks and how they pretend to measure Christian growth and put a number on, you know, numbers on Christian growth. Mm-hmm. I think, what do they think they're measuring? What do they mm-hmm. think they're given a numerical, to have a numerical value to put on that? But it needs to be countable and have a file that goes in at the end of each week and this kind of thing. Yeah.
Someone else?
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Yeah,
look, yeah. Kind of in response to what you're saying about the Christian right's failure to, I guess, achieve in the political realm as they planned, and I guess the church's call in some ways to engage other aspects of culture. I guess, like, for me personally, since college, beyond graduate school, like having been in very politically liberal academic environments, there have definitely been times where I've stepped out of conversations because I feel like if I start talking, not that I necessarily have like views that are totally different, mm-hmm. but that because of the baggage that's mm-hmm. associated with, you know, being Christian, mm-hmm. that could perhaps just close the door to engaging in other respects. And so I guess kind of what you said made me kind of wonder if sometimes it's wiser to like lead in our interactions with our knowledge and appreciation for other aspects of culture, whether it's like art, which, I don't know, maybe it's like a cop out a little bit, because maybe they're not as like controversial or confrontational to talk about. But I think it's something I've definitely wondered, like, when should I or do I even have to be assertive, like, about politics, especially because I feel like that is such, like, the,
Well, a big thing I struggle with a lot is, I think we can go a long way if we can think of questions to ask. Because that doesn't commit you, or it doesn't need to commit you. Certain questions could identify you as exactly where you're coming from. But there's a lot of questions that don't, and don't need to. And you know, people can cruise along talking about politics, and just they really need to. There are things that they need to be to think about and to ask it to raise it as a, in the form of a question. I think is a really is a hopeful direction, because that's a more innocent thing to do. You're not witnessing that you're a know-it-all who knows all the answers to everything, but you're saying, hey, well, this troubles me, but what about this? And I don't know.
Well, Dick has done a lot of, several lectures, and actually some of us are encouraging him to put it into a book, on basically why did Jesus ask so many questions? Because actually, when Jesus really didn't do evangelism, he didn't do what goes by modern definitions of evangelism. He told weird stories, parables, and asked a ton of questions. And you think about it, really ironic, because he's the guy that knows everything. But he asks people questions, which has everything to do with him helping them come to a self-understanding, to be able to come to see themselves and see who God is and who they are in relationship to each other. But hey, I think what Dick said earlier about, you know, unfortunately, we live in a time when Christians have publicly been so catastrophically predictable, that if we use that predictable language, we just turn people off, and they don't actually hear what we want them to hear. So I think, you know, I have found this work on questions, like on the questions of Jesus, really, really helpful and challenging to me to think about what are questions that I get, genuine questions that I end conversation with somebody. You know, sometimes you can just ask somebody, how do you know that? And not say it in an arrogant way, but really, to say I struggle with that, and how have you come to that? But just engaging in questions can be important.
Greg Kokol has a book called Tactics, which has a lot of mm-hmm. stuff about that.
Really?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Two
quick questions.
One at a time.
Yeah. What? Do you have a recommendation for a book on Wilberforce?
I don't. There's a guy.
The Taxis has a chapter on him in one of the books.
Yeah.
So you can think about him. I haven't read any of this stuff.
Yeah, there's a guy called Belmonte who does a lecture here on him, who has written a book about him, but I'm not sure that's the best thing going. there ought to be a good biography somewhere. I don't honestly know. So I'm not up to speed.
Is the Amazing Grace movie accurate enough?
Is what?
The Amazing Grace movie, is that accurate
enough? I guess not terribly.
No.
It gives the general idea, but I guess it isn't.
It doesn't have the Clapham group in it, I don't think, very much, does it?
No.
Well, it does have him meeting with, he has a circle
of
friends,
maybe I'm wrong.
You know, who are very...
Well, but we're probably not really as a group.
Yeah.
It'd be interesting to talk about, to get into, a proper biography would really get into the group itself. And there's a, that would be one of the most interesting things, I think, to study this group. Mm-hmm. It started as just a couple of them in this church in Clapham. I don't know. There's probably
Hoskin has probably knows.
Yeah, he probably would know of a good biography.
There was a talk that I went to, which the author not remember his name, but he wrote a book comparing the lives of Wilberforce and Jefferson. Because they're both abolitionists in some way, but I guess like
except Jefferson Holmes.
Yeah. Jefferson.
Yeah. Or like and so the author was kind of distinguishing these two based on three main categories, I think, like worldview, community, and mentor, and how, like, because Jefferson didn't really have that community or mentor to kind of keep in mind, he kind of fell off the train.
Yeah.
Like, fighting for against slavery, whatever. And so that book, it was like crossed lives, cross purposes.
Huh.
You had a second question.
That'd be interesting.
So thinking about, I guess, the role of government and its role in society, I'm curious if, lately I've been thinking about sort of how we, through science and also I think more recently government, are trying to sort of mitigate the fall, basically, man and the world's sinfulness. And also, your talk tonight, I've been thinking, you mentioned about legalism being one of the defining factors of these sort of insular communities. And it almost seems like in some of these modern political movements, really from both sides, it almost feels like one is doubling down. Like it's like legalism in the church isn't working. You make the government super legalistic and accomplish our goals. Mm. And it's weird because actually from the other spectrum, you also get this sort of like rebelling against the church's legalism, but let's make the government exactly like what we're rebelling against in a way. Like, if through more government, we can actually accomplish. So, but I'm wondering if you had any brief thoughts on.
Not brief ones. David Wells from Gordon Conwell did a series of books. One of them was called Losing Our Virtue, or something like that. And he tracked a lot that the as we lose a sense of Christian morality grounded in God and in the individual's faith and trust in God, okay, what is going to ensure that we have enough civil order to keep us from getting on each other, getting after each other? He was into very much the idea that the incredible rash of litigation is stepping into the emptiness of a lack of faith based moral principles, and for example, Edmund Burke would be someone you'd really want to think about on this. He's an Irish MP who was on the American side at the Revolution. He argued for the American side, but his whole thing was only a virtuous people, internally virtuous, can be really free. If they're not virtuous by their internal gyroscope, you're going to have to lay laws on top of them all over the place to make them civil, to have civility, and he's the one that hammers that point very hard, Edmund Burke. David Wells is sort of chasing it here. I mean, he gives the example. Some of us may have remembered the event that somewhere in Watertown, I think, these kids were playing in a sandbox, and a little boy, 6 years old, kissed a little girl who was about 5 or 6 years old. The mother freaked out, and the thing went to the police for sexual assault. You know, 6 years old, on 5 years old or 6 years old, 6 years old. It got a lot. It was a legal case against this poor kid for sexual assault, and everybody thought, who is? But yet, and his point is that, well, where does someone turn for order for what they, you know, they're very anxious, obviously, and thin-skinned and so forth, and can't roll with. And don't have a community that will help them roll with things like that, and say, hey, you know, this isn't actually the end of the world, and this isn't a thing of deathly seriousness, and so I think that's certainly going to be the point, and who is to step in to bring order if it isn't the state? Because there's nobody else out there who can do it, and of course we need just this whole culture of litigation to pull that off, which is terribly discouraging and stultifying and everything else. Yeah.
Ben used the phrase chickening out, and this guy used the phrase copping out. When do you feel like we actually are chickening out in our personal interactions with people and missing evangelistic opportunities, not being assertive enough? Like, do we give ourselves a pass all the time and say, oh, you know, I shouldn't feel guilty about that? Or...
No.
I don't know. I think we can be... It totally depends on your temperament.
And the situation, and how well you know people.
And... Yeah. But, I mean, you may be the sort of person who likely beat up yourself on every occasion. Or maybe to never beat up on yourself for anything. So you may need to adjust.
Adjust accordingly.
Yeah. And so sometimes, you know, we really will see that this is an opportunity missed, and we should take account of that and say, you know, I need to be more, we need to be quicker. I find I can think a situation doesn't sound quite right, and then it's over, it's gone, but then countless times I say something, and the right thing to say comes to me the next day, and I kick my butt around the street for that. But I don't know. I think the more we do, the more we get better at it, and able to be wise and not just cop out. I mean, yeah, we can. If we're aiming at it, I think we can learn. I mean, one never is beyond copping out, but it's sometimes a situation happens and is past you before you really are quick enough to get a hold of it. That's what I find, anyway. Yeah.
I've been reading in Luke, and I forget exactly where this is, but where, you know, Jesus talks about not being ashamed of him, and I pray that I think not being ashamed of him is real. It's sort of very dependent on how much we appreciate what he's done for us and what our hope is in him, and our relationship with him. Mm-hmm. We're getting to know our neighbors. We've lived where we do now about for coming on to 7 years, and we have wonderful neighbors. There's a few sort of nominal Catholics, not sure kind of where they're at, but we've been having meals with a number of them, and we have a meal coming up with two different neighbors who are, we've had really interesting interactions with them, and some of them have been here, been to different things, came to the art sale here, came to a lecture, came to Ben's lecture on the music of the Civil Rights Movement, and she's a Unitarian Universalist, vegan Unitarian Universalist, and a lovely person, has given money to LaBrie. She's so grateful. It's, you know, fairly small check, but three times now. And we're really praying for, we're having dinner with her family and another family who are a woman who's a psychologist, philosophy, runs all kinds of arts things all around Hawkington and is a poet, and they're just intrigued. They can't figure us out. They're really intrigued with LaBrie. As I said, one of them has actually been to some things here. Actually, the other one has too, because she brought her to the arts thing. And so they're just trying to figure us out and have started, you know, have asked questions about, well, what do you, I remember Kathleen asking me, well, when people come here and they don't believe the way you do, how do you deal with that? I mean, she's really, obviously, is very, they're turned off by what they see as evangelicals. Mm-hmm. Evangelicalism's hardcore, you know, we've got the truth and you don't, kind of ideally.
Compulsion to evangelize.
Yeah, yeah. But they're intrigued. They like us. Their kids like us. And so we're having a meal with the whole family. So we're just praying very much for the same thing. Mm-hmm. Praying, really praying for wisdom, because I have no doubt there will be, every time we have spoken with these people, there have been things about the Christian faith come up, things about our own stories, how we, you know, just how we both were not raised Christians. So just that's interesting for us, how we became, how we stumbled into this yeah. view of things. And they felt free to tell us sort of their stories. You know, this couple got married and they wanted nothing to do with Christianity or our church wedding, but then at the last minute one of them did want a church wedding, and why?
Yeah.
Wanted something that gave more sanctity to it somehow. And so, I don't know. But we've been, just careful to not be predictable, but haven't tried to hide what we're doing. And of course, we can't really, someone said, well, what do you do? What is your work? Well, you're into Christian things. But then questions like that, well, but do you try to persuade people who aren't Christians? And then how do you respond to that? Mm-hmm. Try to help people really think through what and why they believe. And yes, we believe, we believe the Christian worldview is really true, but we're not ramming things down people's throats. We want them to think through what they believe and why, and want to make a safe place where people can, who haven't felt safe raising doubts and questions before. And anyway, it's, you know, you can pray for us, because in a couple of weeks we're having dinner with these two families and who are very, very interested in LaBrie and in us, and they don't kind of fit in the box that they maybe think we should. I don't know. But we've gotten to know them. I needed help gardening. I knew this woman was homeschooling her kids, so I asked, one of your kids want to earn some money helping me dig my garden. And that's, I got to know the 8-year-old that way, and now he's 11. And he, for some reason, loves to work with this 69-year-old woman digging her garden, and we work outside together. He talks about the Unitarian church they go to. And we, anyway.
Okay, anything else? Teresa, should we call it a night?
Good job,
Dick.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Right.
So most people are happy with coming here. But I think that's these magic things that make people, you know, go, I don't want to. So I'm fine being content right here. Yeah. You know, and that's really refreshing.
Thought of this while you were asking questions and stuff. I actually went to Amsterdam